It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Governor Larry Hogan's administration has touted Maryland as a leader in protecting the environment. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. This Sunday, the nation will celebrate Earth Day, so we thought we'd take a look at how the state of Maryland is doing when it comes to dealing with environmental issues. The Hogan administration has boasted about legislation that would cut greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030. Meanwhile, its congressional delegation, including its lone Republican, Andy Harris, fought to keep the restoration funds for the Chesapeake Bay that had come under the Trump administration's budgetary knife. Take a look at these issues. We have in our studio this morning Alan Gerard. He's with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, also environmental writer Tom Horton. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Don.
So, well, let me turn to you, Alan, just to start off. How do you assess where we are, particularly in terms of restoration of the bay, in terms of the environment on the eastern shore as we head into the weekend and in the Earth Day?
Well, it is Earth Day tomorrow, and at least for this portion of the Earth, the news is very good. We have been seeing declines in the average low oxygen dead zone in the bay. We have been seeing increases in underwater grasses. Crab numbers are rebounding. The progress on bay restoration is good, and it's continuing. This is not by accident. This is because citizens, businesses, and government have been partnering under what we call the Chesapeake Clean Water Blueprint to commit to achieving reductions of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment. These are the chief pollutants that are causing health problems for the bay, and putting together plans and programs to achieve those goals. Everybody's working together to do it. It's been happening for the last couple decades, and the bay is responding. It's really a tremendous success story of how to restore an estuary.
How do you rate the state in terms of not only what it's been doing, which obviously you applaud, but also the governor Hogan's approach to all of this?
Well, you know, we just came out of the Maryland General Assembly, and there's good news in terms of funding for bay restoration. With leadership from Governor Hogan, we did commit $53 million to the Chesapeake Atlantic Coastal Bays Trust Fund. This is the resource that's used to help treat non-point pollution from farms and stormwater and places like that. So we're seeing some progress there in terms of that funding commitment. Program Open Space. This is the funding that pays for parks and playgrounds, puts easements to protect farms from development in place. That was funded at record levels, $253 million, again, with leadership from Governor Hogan. We haven't seen that fund raided this year, which is the first time in almost 8 years that that's happened. So good news on the funding, and Governor Hogan deserves credit for that. The General Assembly, of course, endorsed those proposals of his, and now we have a good, strong budget going into the next fiscal year.
And finally, looking at Congress, how do you see them? We've got a farm bill. We did get got the restoration of the Chesapeake Bay funds. Where are they?
Well, President Trump last year proposed zeroing out funding for the Chesapeake Bay program. That's a $73 million program that is essentially the glue that is holding the whole restoration effort together, setting targets for restoration, making sure that the best science is informing progress, and providing resources to help states do their jobs. That is really the thing that is responsible for bringing people to the table and causing the progress that's been happening. Congress just restored that funding to $73 million. It was proposed to be zeroed out from the administration. They decided to keep it at levels it has been. Now the question is, where will we budget the restoration in FY19? The president has proposed a 90% cut rather than a 100% cut. Congress is now debating what levels to restore it at. We think they will proceed based on the good progress that's been happening.
Tom, I want to turn to you because a lot of the activity seems to be at the state level. We have, you know, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which Maryland's a part of, a number of states now joining the U.S. Climate Alliance and so on. And yet we have an administration in Washington which seems bent on rolling back.
Yeah, it's ironic. You know, we really I can give you my take on Hogan a little later if you want.
Sure.
He's had some good points, some bad points. But been pretty strong on air, this Regional Greenhouse Initiative, which is a consortium of states to not only reduce CO2, but to reduce the nitrogen oxides. You know, the pollution from the air is about a third of bay pollution. So the good news is when we reduce CO2 by cutting back on fossil fuel emissions, we also reduce nitrates, nitrogen, the principal pollutant of the bay. But even as Maryland moves pretty aggressively on that with other states, Scott Pruitt and the Trump administration are proposing to just roll back air quality standards across the board, including vehicle fuel efficiency standards. And what they have proposed, I think, pretty clearly just dramatically sets back all of the good stuff that is going on at the state level around the bay. In the Bay region on air quality, we're not gonna make the kind of progress we need on the Bay if what the feds are proposing now takes effect. And I don't see the majority party in Congress making a peep about that. So that's very troubling. And you know, while the EPA Bay money has been restored, there have been a lot of cuts in other agencies that are central to restoring the bay, like NOAA, which does a lot of the monitoring, a lot of the fishery stuff. So, you know, we're getting it's so ironic. You know, a scientist friend told me right after Trump was elected, he said if Trump had half a brain, he would see that the bay is turning a corner, pay credit for it. He could have used this bay thing to present himself as a champion of the environment, which he's not, but he could have done it. And it went the other way. I can only conclude he just got bad advice on that one.
You mentioned a moment ago. So what's your assessment of the current governor?
You know, Hogan, as Alan said, you got to give him credit on open space. That was huge, funding open space. He's been very good on that, which protects a lot of land in Maryland. On air, pretty darn good. I like Ben Grumbles. He's got a very good professional, smart environmental secretary, and that's really helping keep us in the ballgame on a lot of things. Where Hogan is from bad to horrible are a couple areas. Fisheries, he has just devastated the Department of Natural Resources approach to fisheries management. I like watermen. I lived on Smith Island for 3 years. You need to listen to them. He's just given it away to watermen on fisheries, and he's fired good people. He's demoted good people. I don't see how anybody could work for the Maryland Fisheries Administration now and go to work very happy every day. But the other place I worry about Hogan, he's got pretty much a developer mindset when it comes to transportation, way too much emphasis on more roads in an era when everyone knows we got to think broader in terms of mobility, mass transit, bicycles, pedestrian, complete streets, all the greeny stuff you hear on making cities more mobile as opposed to more trafficked. The other thing, Maryland's got a pretty strong land use control now in this act passed under O'Malley that doesn't allow major subdivisions on septic tanks. It keeps the sprawl out of the farmland and the forest land. Hogan clearly doesn't like that. I think if he could repeal it, he would. He's too smart to know he can do that. But in some counties like Cecil County, he's pretty much winked and nodded and told them, go ahead and be bad. And that's going to snowball, I'm afraid. So, you know, he's done some good stuff. He's done some bad stuff. You got to give him some credit.
Just on the fisheries piece, I mean, oysters are wildly popular in Maryland. You know, we had done some polling a few months ago, asking voters in Maryland, do you support investing in oyster sanctuaries? And something like well over 80% of the people responded. They very strongly support that. People think that the oysters are a key piece of what we need to be paying attention to when we're restoring the health of the bay, and they're right. And we are actually in the midst of a making history campaign. Look, we've been making this progress. What do we need to do to make sure the progress continues? A consortium of over 25 organizations, watermen, oyster farmers, nonprofit organizations, academics are coming together and saying, we need to engage the public on this issue. We need to draw more media attention. Thanks for having us on the program this morning. Right. We need more government action and funding to ensure that oysters are managed by science. And this is where the effort on the Department of Natural Resources comes into play. And also that we are boosting up oyster farming. These are pieces of the puzzle when it comes to bringing back oysters. We need the department to be a partner on this and ensure that we're bringing back this species commensurate with what people want in this state.
You know, if you brought someone in from Mars and you said, we got this fishery, it's called oysters, they're down to about 1% of their historical abundance. How many more should we catch? They'd say, catch? Are you crazy? You've caught 99%. You want me to tell you how many of the last 1% you should catch? But of course, we're not from Mars. Oysters are oyster harvesting is part of our history and culture. And so we continue to debate the last 1%. We fight over how many we should take.
Because I was going to ask you, because, you've been on a shore, all the watermen, the culture. What do you say to watermen who say, hey, look, we have to make a living? Some believe that the numbers are not quite as the state government says it is. How do you pierce that culture and that self-interest?
I'm not saying there can be no wild harvest of oysters in a sustainable fashion, but I doubt we can continue to do it like we're doing it now, using power dredging in a lot of areas, which is awfully efficient way to do it. In fact, the only reason people can make a living anymore is to use that efficient way. If you went back to hand tongs only and sail dredging, people couldn't make a living because oysters have been depleted. I think I would say clearly politically the state is putting more emphasis on oyster farming now, because that way you can still give people all the oysters they want to eat. It's a good thing for the economy. But quite frankly, not every wild harvester is a little businessman waiting to become an oyster farmer. There are different skill sets, different mindsets. So that's a reality. I'm not sure we shouldn't look at some kind of a license buyout for wild oyster harvesting.
You think that culture's going to die out?
Well, many people smarter than I have been predicting that for about a century. So,
and they're still there.
Let me just hedge a little bit on that. But sure, I think it is. It's already declined quite a bit. And one of the complications, okay, let's say we buy all the oystermen out, we end wild oyster harvesting. How much more pressure does that put on crabbing, on rockfish? We're already down quite a bit from the array of species we could harvest. Can't do shad anymore, can't do terrapins, snapping turtles getting more, eeling getting more regulated. So it's not an easy solution. The good news is, we have done a bang-up job of putting two major bay fisheries, rockfish and crabs, on a pretty sustainable basis where lots of people can make a good living, and we don't worry so much about over-harvesting. Have we done it? We've applied the science. We've funded the science. We have followed up the science with reasonably wise regulation and pretty good enforcement. Where you do that, you win. Where you don't, shad and oysters and maybe menhaden, you lose. And that's kind of the lesson I take from the last 30 years of trying to manage bay fisheries.
turn to the poultry industry. And there's a lot of efforts to deal with the manure, with nutrients that run off. Alan, where do you think we are with that? We had a phosphorus commission and some regulations and so on. And I was talking to Jim Perdue the other day, and he thought that the farming and the agriculture industry was, you know, doing had made great strides in terms of dealing with these particular issues. How do you assess?
I think it's important to take the long view with agriculture. You know, you look back several decades, University of Maryland invested heavily in trying to understand how to most efficiently reduce nutrients that come from farmland. Right here on the Eastern Shore, the Y Research and Education Center, Ken Staver and Russ Binsfield did pioneering research on a cover crop scenario that now has become a model for the country. Maryland invests in cover crops planted in the fall after the summer crops are harvested that are very effective at scavenging any nutrients that are left over in the soil from fertilizer applied to the summer crop. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 or 600,000 acres are now planted in Maryland. That's a significant portion of Maryland's farmland that's under cover crop. That is likely a major reason why we're seeing improvement in water quality today. Maryland farmers are pioneers in no-till. This is managing farmland in a way that minimizes disturbance to the soil, limit plowing, limit disking, plant your crop right into residue so that the soil is less disturbed. There's lots of evidence showing that that is very good for soil health, very good for water quality, very good for farmers' bottom lines. So there's a lot of progress that's been done in the agriculture sector. On phosphorus, there's evidence that there has been over-application of manure on some farms in Maryland, a significant portion of Maryland's Lower Eastern Shore, Sussex County, Delaware, show that there are excessive levels of phosphorus to the point now that Maryland has regulated farmers and is requiring them, if they have what they call this phosphorus index value. It's essentially an assessment of what is the risk of phosphorus leaving the field. If those levels are high, you are required no longer to apply poultry litter. That regulation is being phased in over a number of years. It was a 10 or 15 year debate backed by a lot of science, a lot of people on both sides. We came to agreement to move forward with the regulation, and now the regulation is being implemented. We will see how well it gets implemented. There are questions about four regions of Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, in the coastal plain here, you know, where farmers are no longer able to apply poultry litter. How are they going to get the fertility needs of their crop met? Where is the litter that's being produced nearby those farms going to go? Maryland and the poultry industry have invested modestly in transporting that manure from high phosphorus areas to low phosphorus areas. There's evidence on the Upper Shore that farm fields there can receive this manure safely and have it applied. So there's a lot of discussion now about what to do with the excess level, what the excess level is, and we'll see where we go from here.
Tom, what about you?
I think Alan covered the situation. How well and how rapidly we are implementing this restriction of spreading poultry manure on soils that are saturated with phosphorus, it's a question mark. I don't know. My sense is a bit slow, but we are moving in the right direction. I'd like to see more, you know, transparency and a report on that. But generally, I think he's correct in what he's saying. Cover crops is a huge success. The failure is most of the rest of the Bay watershed, especially Pennsylvania. We got to get cover crops all over. Maryland can't do it alone. One thing that I was a little sorry to see go down to defeat in the legislature was an attempt to monitor the air coming out of chicken houses. A modern chicken house, to keep the chickens healthy, is designed around quickly exhausting the ammonia, which is to say nitrogen-laden air. Where does that travel? How far does it go? Is it a significant source of pollution to our waterways? Is it all falling out 10 feet from the house? We need to know this stuff. The bill to do that failed. The poultry industry opposed it. I am told it is not dead. It's going to summer study. So perhaps we'll come out of it with a good bill. But that's an aspect of poultry that we've sort of been punting EPA and the states down the road for a while, and we need to figure out what we're looking at there.
Just quickly on agriculture, the House is debating a farm bill. You know, farmers in Maryland throughout the Chesapeake Bay region, they help protect our air. They help manage their resources so it doesn't impact water quality, and they produce healthy food. They are a big part of our community here. The farm bill provides resources to farmers to make sure that farmers can farm profitably and water quality is protected. The House passed a measure out of committee that is concerning. It reduces cost share payments for farmers that invest in water quality practices. And we need to make sure that legislators are aware, look, farmers have been great partners in this work because the federal government has stepped in and provided resources to help them get the job done. We need to make sure that continues.
We've been speaking with Alan Gerard. He's with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, also environmental writer Tom Horton. As we approach Earth Day, and we appreciate you guys stopping by and chatting with us.
Well, good to be here.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Ward Foundation is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In 1968, the Ward Foundation was established to celebrate and promote wildfowl art and to preserve the legacy of the Eastern Shore's most famous decoy carvers, Lim and Steve Ward. The Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art was established in 1976 on the campus of Salisbury University and moved to its current location in 1992 on South Shoemaker Drive in Salisbury. Coming up at the end of this month, the museum will hold the 48th annual Ward World Championship Wildfowl Carving Competition Art Festival at the Roland E. Powell Convention Center in Ocean City. In our studio this morning is Laura Botinelli. She's the executive director of the museum. And also, we have Kent Kimmel. He is chairman of the board of the Ward Foundation. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Laura, I want to start first with you and talk a little bit about this anniversary that's coming up.
So this is our 50th anniversary of the Ward Foundation, and we're going to be celebrating all year the wonderful achievements of the foundation and its relationship with the community. Some of the people want to know about the parties, right? Because if you have a 50th anniversary, you might have a large gathering. So on October 12th, we're going to have our Golden Goose reception and auction at the museum, which is the Friday night before one of our annual events that's normally held at the museum. But right now, you can come to the museum and see our retrospective exhibit on the foundation. It's called 50 Years of Art, Nature, and Tradition. It's in our welcome gallery, and it'll be in there through August, so you can get a sense of the people, the art, the organizations, and the relationships that help this foundation come together. We're doing lots of other things, like doing a lot of media, so thank you for having us here to celebrate. The 50th anniversary really aligned with sort of a capstone year for the Ward Museum already. As you know, last year we just finished renovations of our museum facility. We greatly expanded our educational programs and have had a lot of ways to build and create new relationships throughout Salisbury and the greater Delmarva Peninsula. So a lot of people are discovering the Ward Museum for the first time. And then for them to understand that the Ward Foundation has been, you know, 50 years in the making to what we're seeing here in 2018.
So, Kent, how do you see the significance of the foundation and particularly the museum itself?
Well, I think the significance of the foundation is the members of the board who oversee and have a fiduciary responsibility, obviously, to the museum. So much of our work is making sure that we understand to be able to work with our community leaders in getting the museum to be a major part, social part, educational part of the community.
So what kind of impact do you think that's had in terms of preserving the legacy of not only the Ward Museum, the Ward Brothers, but of sort of this Eastern Shore tradition, as it were?
Well, one of our mission statements is that we reflect on the heritage of the maritime communities of the Eastern Shore of Maryland in particular, and throughout the United States and abroad. We have partnered on numerous occasions with facilities outside of the region, so that we're trying to bring knowledge of our part of the history of the Eastern Shore to the Western Shore, if you will. And through the World Championship every April in Ocean City, we bring people from all around the world. We have people here from England and Japan and France, Russia, who are competitors. So one of the things that we're attempting to do is to, in some sense, make the Ward Museum a destination for visitors and for our locals.
Laura, so are there any special themes, by the way, in this celebration? What kinds of things are you emphasizing in terms of highlighting the traditions here?
Well, so part of what we're trying to do this year is find a way to reach out to the many different communities the Ward Museum serves. So as Dr. Kimmel just referenced, so at our World Championship event soon, we're going to have our international membership of artists that come and support us each year. We have a special exhibit that's going to be going on this summer that's going to be engaging many local artists from a variety of media. It's called Through the Artist's Eyes. So we know over the many years we've had artists who've had relationships with the Ward and maybe have had limited opportunities to exhibit. We also, through our educational programming, have a wide reach. And so we've had our student art show this year reflected on the 50th anniversary. The materials that we bring into the classroom recognize that while we're learning about sort of the environment of today, that the history of the Eastern Shore is very much connected to waterfowling and marsh life and the relationships between land and water. So for early learners, we look at those themes. When we look at visitors, again, these communities that we serve and these themes that we're pushing, for our visitors, we want them to realize that when you come to Salisbury, that there are gems within our cultural and arts community that they can discover. We are a destination for tourists who are traveling up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And so if they come and pick the Ward Museum as one of their stops, we want to make sure that we're referring them to the other heritage organizations and arts organizations throughout the shore. And we see that as an important role. And in our 50th year, even more important because it's showing the breadth and scope of all the relationships we have. We are also doing work with Salisbury University in our 50th year to generally recognize the educational impacts that we've had through our relationships with campus, to have the students involved in the celebration. So, you know, I get this question about how do we connect with all these many people that we have relationships with? And it's really, the approach is different depending on who you're meeting with. Beyond who I just mentioned, there are a number of other groups who engage regularly with the Ward. You know, our volunteers, they may be doing this as like a civic and social opportunity. And so involving them in the 50th anniversary celebrations lets them bring in more family, more friends to the museum to help us build our group of supporters for years to come. So it is just as the theme is to connect with all of the various groups of people that have had or we feel should have a relationship with this organization that celebrates art, nature, and tradition. We've been working over the years to really expand the reach of the Ward. I know for many years we may have been seen as that duck museum.
Duck museum.
That
really?
Duck museum. Has anyone called us that? And and that's true. We have some carved ducks in the building.
Right. Only a few, right?
Only a few. But I think people are refreshed when they start coming. In the past few years, they've been coming to the museum and seeing that it really is this broad connection between art, nature, and tradition. And while ducks in decoys pull that together pretty fully in relationship to our mission, you know, that there's lots of other ways that people are connecting with those themes, whether they're bird watchers or they're painters or they're digital photographers or they're people who are studying the marsh and the Chesapeake Bay and the relationships to the waterfront. All those things come together at the museum through our programming. And the way that we've been able to grow and is to expand those connections. So the theme this year is to remember all the ways that people are able to connect with our organization.
So let me just sort of put this on pause for a moment and sort of reach back a little. And you and I, Laura, have talked about this. Talk about the origins of the decoy, because obviously in the early days, with particularly colonists here, but even early Americans, hardly the kind of elaborate things that we now see. Tell us a little bit about that history.
Okay, well, the basics are people need to eat, right? So we start with that. And we live along the Atlantic Flyway, which is a major migratory path for birds. And so the early techniques for hunting, whether you're using bow and arrow or, you know, early guns, is that you have to be able to fool those migratory birds closer to the hunter. And so, you know, you might think of a wooden decoy that floats on the water, but you can fool a bird with other things, whether it's a hump of marsh grass or something like that. So Native Americans of our area were using various techniques. And then as the settlers came to the area, they sort of adapted and expanded on the ways in which to fool these birds so that they could gun them for food. The wooden decoy over time became very reliable. It was sturdy, it was movable, it would last multiple seasons. And so as people started using these wooden decoys throughout the Mid-Atlantic and across the United States and beyond, the carving styles of the communities that were making them began to were distinct, because we'll say a dozen or so guys carving the decoys to hunt in this one area were sharing techniques, they were sharing the tools, and they began to make the decoys a certain way. And then more people in their area started to make the decoys a certain way. And that's why decoys in Long Island look so much different than decoys on the lower Chesapeake.
And, of course, you have, I guess, different birds as well.
Exactly. So there's different species of birds, and depending on there was changes in waterfowl population, so certain times, periods of history would have a lot more redheads decoys carved and canvasback decoys, and then one year all the redheads would be repainted to be canvasback because they needed them to be different. And Dr. Kimmel, you know a little bit about this.
Go ahead.
Even the difference between the upper bay and the lower bay. I'm a collector. I collect one species of bird, and I have probably over 60. And it's very interesting to look at those decoys because you can not only distinguish upper bay from lower bay, but you can also distinguish one carver from another. And you can also relate one carver to another carver, who was the teacher, who was the student. It's a fascinating hobby, and for me it's still a hobby, an expensive hobby, but it's a hobby. one of the things that I always thought was interesting, and when I first started working at the museum, I was giving tours as a docent, and Laura was talking about moving from the decoy as an object to try to draw in live birds when they were hunting. One of the things that fascinated me was that there was a time period when hunters used live birds, and they literally they would take something like a pigeon, in colonial times we were hunting songbirds, but shorebirds, but to take a live pigeon and tie it to a perch and hide behind a bush someplace, and they would move the perch up and down so the bird would flap its wings and draw in as a decoy. The perch that the bird was tied to was called a stool. If they put a pigeon on that, that's where the term stool pigeon came from.
Ah, okay.
Which I always found fascinating. And an aside to looking at where the decoys came from.
Now, of course, then we have, I guess, a law in 1918, which bars the sale. Laura, tell me a little bit about that. And because it seems to me, as I was doing the research on this, that dramatically changes in many ways this moving from a practical implement, which it still was being used as such, but into a much more ornamental item.
So in that time, around 1918, waterfowl and migratory bird populations were in bad shape. They had been heavily depleted by the gunners who were harvesting large amounts of protein to be able to be sold to feed the growing population in the United States. It was also during the heyday of the feather trade with ladies' hats and things like that. So the law really was a capstone against what was one of the very first sort of environmental challenges of our country, was to how to protect these migratory bird populations. So the big piece of the law that affects the hunting tradition is that you are no longer able to sell wild game meat in at market.
Right.
Which before, so you'd have a group of market gunners who would go out and they'd harvest hundreds of birds, hundreds and hundreds of birds, probably stick them on a train and send them up to the New York City game market,
Philly,
and to feed the city populations. Right. So this law prohibited them from doing that. You still could hunt for subsistence, and you still could hunt for a recreation. There wasn't as much recreation hunting at the time, but it certainly was enjoyable. So now what that meant was a number of those folks who were hunting those large quantity of birds to feed population switched over to guiding services and gunning club services, because there still was the experience of the marsh and people who still wanted to have a connection and get there. So those skills transferred to a new industry, which was sport. We'll call it gun clubs.
Right.
Gun clubs, yes.
Hunting guides.
Sports clubs, right.
Right. And then the continuation of subsistence hunting. So that break, then the decoy began to be used as a tool that maybe was being visible to a lot more affluent clientele who maybe wanted to take that decoy home with them after they went and visited one of these remote maritime communities. But the decoy was the tool. You couldn't let it go. The next group had to hunt with it. So they started the carver started carving these miniatures, which could be taken home as souvenirs for those guys that had come out for these sporting excursions. And then, you know, eventually maybe some other of these the regular decoys were brought home. And those things were put on shelves. And maybe someone picked up a working decoy and went and put it on a shelf because the food that they had hunted was consumed, but they wanted this memory of the experience in the marsh. Mm-hmm. So that kind of began the push of the decoy into sort of have a decorative quality. And it's the same instinct of when you have this beautiful handmade quilt, which was made to keep you warm. And then someone says, well, let's hang that up on the wall. It doesn't make it not a quilt anymore. Right. But it is looked at for its decorative value. You can take it back down and you can put it back on your bed and use it the same way you could take any decoy that was put up on a shelf and throw it back in the water and hunt with it. But you enjoy it has this new value. So more decoy makers began to carve more birds that could be sold for just strictly to be put on the shelf. And then these competitions to see who could make the best decoy really began to take root in the 60s and 70s. And that's where the Ward Foundation basically right. blossomed from. The Ward brothers were competing at those contests, being some of the best decoy carvers recognized in the country, winning all the awards at these decoy contests. And they got sort of some namesake out of it. People started buying more of their birds, and then people realizing these guys are really quite special. And we haven't talked about why they're special yet. We'll get to that.
Right.
And then our foundation was established in 1968, and our first activities were to hold exhibition and competitions right. to get more of these decoys that were becoming recognized as beautiful objects as well as working objects, you know, together and be able to be seen by the public.
Can you talk about it? You're a collector. And I understand, as a matter of fact, some of these things are signed either by the carver, or some of them actually have the names of the sporting clubs, as it were. I mean, tell us a little bit about that, since you're really into this.
Yeah. I was just going to say, to follow up on what Laura said about the particularly with the gunning clubs, the makers, I like to refer to them artists or artisans, had their own personal style. And many times they were carving for a club, and the club would collect a number of decoys of the same species, which is called a raft. And when they would go out on the river to hunt, they would put out a raft of maybe 200 decoys. If the club owned the decoys, many times they branded or carved the name of the club in the bottom of the decoy. There were many times when the carver would put some kind of mark on the bottom, either carve their name or their initials, or they had a special mark, some way of identifying. Some carvers made their identification in the weight that goes on the bottom of the decoy. many of them, there. I have a friend who collects, and one of the things that he does is he has his decoys X-rayed. And you can tell an age of the decoy depending on the X-ray and whether they have square head nails in them, so hand-wrought nails. So we can tell whether they've come from before the Civil War or after the Civil War. And the idea of collecting. One of the things that people now collect, and I have started, but I'm not into it like so many others, is to look for brands on the bottom of a decoy. So it may be the brand of the carver. It may be the brand of the hunt club, of the scow on from which hunting was took place. It might be the collector puts his mark on it. I know I have one decoy that I got in North Carolina because it had the Ward stamp on the bottom of it, because it had been in an exhibition here, had been it wasn't in the permanent collection, but it was in the collection enough to put in the museum. So it meant something to me to bring that decoy, even though it was a North Carolina decoy, bring it back because it had at one time had a home here.
So I'm going to jump in because now listeners are like, well, there's that decoy over on my cousin's shelf. I wonder if it's anything.
Is it?
Right. All right. So first step, ask your cousin if you can take it down off the shelf. Don't grab it by the head. Grab it by the body. And you look at it. And you know what Dr. Kimmel was saying is you turn it over and you look at the bottom. When a decoy collector, first thing they do is flip a bird over.
Yep.
And you begin to read the bottom of the bird. You get to see if it was ever weighted, so if it was ever hunted on. You can see the condition of the bird. You can see what these layers of ownership that may be on the bottom of the bird, or it may be very distinctly signed by the maker. The newer birds, that's usually what you're going to be seeing, is you're going to see the artist's signature and they'll have dated it. Okay, so then once you do that, you might figure out what kind of duck it is, you know, what species of waterfowl. And that way you can talk about it as a canvasback or a redhead or scalp or something like that. And if you really think you might have something or want to know about it, there are opportunities to have those birds looked at and appraised and identified. The museum has events throughout the year. The most significant one is in October. But there's a number of relationships we have with people in the area who can help you figure out what your bird is. And there's a chance that there's a treasure. You know, only 2 weeks ago, I was told a story where somebody was helping someone move out of a kitchen and they knew they had some decoys up there above the cabinet. And they pulled the first two down, $50 decoy, $50 decoy. And then there was a Ward Brothers bluebill up there on the shelf. And it had a crack in the bill or whatever, but it was still a very cool find. And some things are just tucked away and you never know what may come out of...
Let's go to the antique show, right?
That's right. Exactly. Well, at the antique show, I bet you, the antique show gets picked pretty heavily by knowledgeable collectors. Mm-hmm. It's going, you know, the finds are really in those little crevices that you might have access to, you know,
right.
That, you know, it's somebody's, especially old garages.
I go through every old garage here on the Eastern Shore hunting for. Well, speaking of the Ward Brothers, they're probably one of the most famous set of folks who carved decoys. Laura, tell us a little bit about them. They have a little barber shop down,
yep.
A place near Crisfield, but there's also they would carve, and then they had obviously their rooms in the back as well.
So you know a lot about this, right? And I would hope that most listeners on Delmarva have heard about the Ward Brothers. They're very famous people from the Eastern Shore who've grown an international
reputation.
They were born and raised in Crisfield, Maryland, out on Sacratown Road near Jenkins Creek. And they learned to carve from their father because they needed to hunt, out in the marsh. They were barbers by trade, and they had a fourth grade education. And in between haircuts, they'd carve these birds. So as more people started coming through Crisfield, and especially there were some major gunning clubs that were down in our area, and with the booms and busts of seafood and some of the wealth that came into Crisfield, people started to realize that these Ward Brothers were carving these really exceptional decoys, and they began to get more and more direct commissions. And so then their work started to get put in more prominent locations. And then they were featured in National Geographic 3 times in their lifetime. Right. They ended up getting honorary doctorates from Salisbury University and ultimately had the Ward Foundation named for them in 1968. But really, these were these guys that were incredibly affable and would sing in barbershop quartet and wrote poetry about the Eastern Shore.
Painting.
And had that Eastern Shore personality that, you know, this is a person who knows about where they're living and they know what's important about where they're living, and they value people as much as they value the place that they're in. And they built these relationships that extended throughout the Mid-Atlantic and then ultimately nationally before they passed away. So, Ken, I'll let you add on.
Yeah, Ken, and when you're looking at what do you think distinguishes the Ward brothers' decoys from, say, others?
Well, I think they were excellent carvers and painters. They could represent the decoy. I think part of it is the fact that they, for the most part, carved everything by hand. They had a bandsaw. If you go down to the workshop, the old barbershop workshop where they worked, that bandsaw is still there. It's a huge floor-mounted bandsaw. So they rough cut the decoys, but everything was done. They whittled. It was done with a knife. I know that a number of carvers, particularly some up on the Upper Bay, started going to lathe carving, where they had a model, and they would literally, the birds were turned out en masse. Mm-hmm. These were individually done. And one of the fascinating things to me is to go down to the workshop, and on the wall you will see in pencil something written on there, 7 redhead, 15 canvas back, and prices, and 50 cents a piece. So that's $12 for that batch. And you think now about the prices that some of the Ward Brother pieces are getting, you realize that they were there carving decoys for the people around them who were using them to hunt. When they became recognized as excellent carvers, they called them counterfeiters, those prices have gone through the roof, and people recognize the excellence of their ability to carve these decoys, to paint these decoys, to represent the bird itself as an excellent decoy.
And Laura, they seem to like use all kinds of things, everything from the telephone pole, I think I heard the story, to basket, I mean, for the feathers.
The old Navy life rafts that were made out of balsa wood and covered with canvas. When the Second World War was over, carvers would take those old rafts, tear the canvas off of them, and cut up the balsa wood to use for decoys. So telephone poles, anything they could get their hands on.
And then the reverse would happen because they were made of wood. And if you got cold, you might be burning.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I heard that some were burnt, actually.
Yes.
They would just throw them in because.
Yeah. But. I mean, they were coming of age as carvers during the Great Depression.
Right.
And you basically living out of the food that they could get from the marsh and, you know, making the decision about what piece of wood they were going to burn to keep warm that night. And many Ward decoys were burned.
What kind of legacy do you think they leave in terms of contributing to the modern day or the current carvers? I mean, I talked to a couple of carvers for a story we did last year, and one of the things is they talked about how they had learned a great deal. Matter of fact, one of the carvers said they were inspired when they went to one of the exhibits.
Well, I think that's it. I think they have become the Ward brothers have become a standard, which other carvers aspire to. They'll look at the Ward carvings as a model for the quality that they really want to pursue in terms of their own carving. I don't know that the standard on the Eastern Shore from the Ward Brothers' perspective is any greater than it is. There's a competition or a big exhibit coming up in a couple of weeks out in Chicago. I think the Ward Brothers are as well known in Chicago at that competition as they are here. So their name has moved well beyond the Eastern Shore.
So I also understand that after a while, particularly in the 20th century, there was a move away necessarily from wooden carved decoys to plastics and other materials. Mm-hmm. And that diminished the demand for wood carvers. With wood carving, carved decoys. What about that?
Well, I think, yes, that did happen. And I think that From a collector's perspective, most of my collection is 1960 and before, because shortly thereafter we started getting into a lot more decorative carving as opposed to the working decoys, the stool decoys, as they're called. And there was a lot more emphasis on mass production. So there were either these decoys, wood decoys that were turned out on lathes, or there were decoys that were molded in plastic. And so what happened then was those guys who were carving for the market, for the people who were out hunting, began now doing more decorative work. And I've had the good fortune to know a number of those people, and I think they still look to people like the Ward brothers, even though they may not be carving for a working decoy. They look to the Ward brothers for the excellent kind of carving that they did.
So we have, of course, the international competition coming up. Laura, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, how many kinds of entries have you got? Any kind of particular areas of and awards and so on? Tell me about that.
Okay, so the exciting thing is we don't know what's coming until we get there.
But you're supposed to know.
No, carvers have been working on their work for the past year, and it's a debut of their entries. So this is the 48th annual Ward World Wildfowl Carving Competition, and there are divisions from youth to novice, intermediate, advanced, and world championship and masters. So people who have been working to create their best example of the species of bird will bring it into the convention center, and then it'll be judged in their category, go up against ribbons and prizes and awards depending on where they are. We give out about $65,000 worth of cash prizes each year, and I don't know, hundreds of ribbons and certificates and plaques, and the world champions even get a ring and trophies. It's really a capstone for a carver in his or her pursuit of their art form. It is the most prestigious event of its type. So for this community of artists, this is, if you attend and compete at the world championship, you have made it. This is what, and then we have had carvers that have moved all the way from our youth division up to be world champion, which is really amazing. If you think about over these 48 years of doing this show that someone has progressed, that fully. So there's the artwork, and it may be decorative, like high, beautiful sculpture, interpretive carving, sort of more abstract presentations of birds and wildfowl. And then there's a decoy competition, and then the youth competition is really cool. And you still have a chance to do this if you're a young person listening, is we have a silhouette division. And it's basically you're painting a flat cutout in the shape of the bird. And this year it's a red knot, which is a shorebird. And you paint it. We've done this with schools. And so we end up with like hundreds of these, like they're called stick-ups or flatties, these little flat carvings. And then they have the younger person's painting to make it look like an early shorebird decoy. So there's still a chance to enter art. But during the weekend, there's more than just the competition and exhibition of art. There's an auction on Saturday. We have art vendors and art suppliers that rent booths out throughout the convention center. There's a kids' corner where kids can come up and they actually start painting next year's entry for the youth division at that event. And then there's like a birds of prey demonstration. And then we also have this dinner to recognize our living legends. And that celebration is a way for us to honor some of the artists who have made sort of high achievements in the art form. And this year, our honorees are Oliver Toots Lawson, who many know is a carver down from Crisfield. He was actually worked with the Ward brothers in their shop and then has been recognized as one of the great American decoy makers. So he'll be honored, as will David Turner, who everyone probably has seen David's work throughout the Eastern Shore and beyond. He's a bronze sculptor. His studio is in Olney, Virginia, and he has works all throughout Salisbury University. He has some signature monuments in Ocean City itself, works at the Ward Museum, and throughout the United States. So we'll honor David. And then the third is Bob Kerr, or Robert Kerr, who is from Smiths Falls, Ontario, Canada. And he is one of the carvers that At the beginning of the Ward Foundation was sort of one of the namesakes with Lemon Steve that were competing and carving and sort of has held together a community of carvers up in Canada. So we'll be honoring Robert Kerr as well. So it's the weekend is a chance to see a lot of new art, to honor some of the history, to be able, if you're into it, purchase, take home things, to learn. And for kids, there are opportunities for children to, you know, get close, play with a little paint if they like, and to really see the beauty of the art form and the natural world it celebrates.
I think for some of your listeners, I think one of the fascinating things and to go to the convention center, and I would recommend people take some time this weekend, next weekend, I guess it is, the 27th through the 29th, to go to the competition. But just to look at the quality of work that's done from the kids that are there, it amazes me almost every year to look at the quality that some of these young people come up with, and we do have different categories for youth, and to look at the people who are in the novice class, looking at the people who are in the advanced class, they look at people above them in category in the competition, and for people coming there who don't know anything about carving, don't know anything about collecting. Just to look at the quality of the artwork is fascinating. We float birds in tanks inside the convention center. One of the fascinating things to me when I first saw the competition was that the birds are put in the water upside down and they have to right themselves, which is a quality that every decoy has to have so it floats properly in the water. We have a similar competition out in the bay where we literally have the judges on a barge out in the bay, out behind the Civic Center, and people in waders moving the decoys around so they can see. And there have been years when we've had some pretty severe weather and the decoys are judged as they would be in competition or as they would be if you were out hunting. You want to have a piece that really works as a good decoy. So there are so many different things for people coming to the competition to look at. And the different divisions allow you to either look at working birds, decorative birds, song birds, shore birds. There are so many different things to look at. I think last year we had 1,100 pieces in the competition. So it's something that if you go, you take your time and really enjoy what these people are making.
You know, my friend, I went to actually a couple of years ago and took a bunch of photographs. And if you look at the shots, you can't tell that these are carved birds.
Exactly.
I mean, it's truly amazing. We've been talking with Laura Bottinelli. She's the executive director of the Ward Museum. Also, Kent Kimmel. He is chairman of the board of the Ward Foundation, celebrating its 50th anniversary. And again, Laura, real quick with the dates in terms of anniversary and the championship.
Okay, so the World Championship is April 27th, 28th, 29th in Ocean City. And then the 50th anniversary Golden Goose reception and auction is Friday, October 12th.
So we want to, again, encourage you to stop by and take a look at it. Again, I appreciate you guys stopping by and chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host.